It signals the emergence of a new peace initiative with the American nation in the heart of the entire process.
It was like being in a war and you didn't have any guns. They just approached us very quickly, came walking up with the guns, and started shooting people.
There were 910 evacuated from this location. The people, when they committed suicide, stood in nice, neat little circles, children in front of them, and as they died, they folded into the interior of the circle, and there were mounds of people.
We have to put a limit on spending in the federal level in some manner.
There was a huge explosion, and they both caught fire, and the PSA kept the bank that he was into, only he just nosed down about 80 degree angle straight into the ground.
We have to interrupt our usual programs to repeat the sad news of the sudden death of our dear Holy Father, Pope Paul VI.
After 33 days, His Holiness John Paul I died.
The smoke is white. We now have a new pope.
Senator Humphrey passed away quietly in his sleep.
Senators voting in the affirmative, Messrs. Abarask, Anderson, Baker, Bayh, Bellman, Benson, Biden, Brook, Bumpers, Byrd of West Virginia, Cannon, Case, Chafee, Childs, Church, Clark, Cranston, Culver, Danforth, Deacon Sini.
We saw them on radar, and we advised them that they had crossed the coast.
The weight at birth was 2,600 grams, 5 pounds, 12 ounces, and the mother's condition after delivery was excellent.
War and peace. Violent and natural death, human accomplishment. These are part of every year's story, but 1978 brought something new under the sun, a test tube baby. Louise Brown came into the world July 25th, 1978, a wee bit premature but healthy. She made her parents very happy, especially because Leslie and John Brown had been told they'd probably never have children. Dr. Patrick Steptoe took eggs from Mrs. Brown, then mixed them in a dish with Mr. Brown's sperm. For 2.5 days, they developed together in a laboratory culture. Then, they were placed in the mother's uterus through a tube. The procedure bypassed the fallopian tubes, where 30% of all fertility problems occur. A little less than 9 months later, 5-pound, 12-ounce Louise Brown was born. Dr. Steptoe, who estimates he tried the process some 200 times before, saw the far-reaching effects of his success.
We think that within a fairly reasonable time, given the right facilities, that this could become clinically applicable all over the world. But there has to be a reasonable amount of time for its development because the final problems have not been solved.
Steptoe's partner, reproductive physiologist Dr. Robert Edwards, was immediately aware of the ethical questions being raised.
I would say what we have done is brought medical responsibility into the early stages of human life. And if you think of it this way, then what you have to do is take care of the embryo as you would any other human life, which has to be protected and nourished.
The President is pleased to announce that President Sadat and Prime Minister Begin have accepted an invitation to come to Camp David on September 5th for a meeting with the President to seek a framework for peace in the Middle East.
As we meet at Camp David, no one can ensure the degree of success which we might enjoy. The issues are very complicated. The disagreements are deep. Four wars have not led to peace in that troubled region of the world. There is no cause for excessive optimism, but there is also no cause for despair.
The Camp David summit was widely regarded as a last chance for peace. For days, nothing was known about progress or lack of it. Finally, on a Sunday night, helicopters flew the three leaders to the White House for a hastily prepared broadcast.
When we first arrived at Camp David, the first thing upon which we agreed was to ask the people of the world to pray that our negotiations would be successful. Those prayers have been answered far beyond any expectations.
Agreements were reached on two frameworks for peace. There was an overall framework for peace in the Middle East and a separate framework for the conclusion of a peace treaty between Israel and Egypt. Under the terms of the agreement, the Israelis and Egyptians promised to sign a peace treaty within 3 months, leaving much to be done.
In the weeks ahead, important decisions have to be made if we are to proceed on the road to peace. We have to reaffirm the faith of the Palestinian people in the ideal of peace.
And indeed, we shall go on working in understanding and in friendship and with goodwill. We will still have problems to solve. Camp David proved that any problem can be solved if there is goodwill and understanding and some wisdom.
No further talks were needed to get agreement from the two leaders on the critical role President Carter played.
For long days and nights, you devoted your time and energy to the pursuit of peace. You have been most courageous when you took the gigantic step of convening this meeting. The challenge was great, and the risks were high, but so was your determination.
The Camp David conference should be renamed. It was the Jimmy Carter conference.
Jimmy Carter's involvement continued as the euphoria passed and the difficult discussions began over the emotional issue of Palestinian autonomy in the Israeli-occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip territories. Even before these issues could be agreed on, the two Middle East leaders were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. Begin phoned Sadat with congratulations.
You remember, Mr. President, when we were in Ismailia, I told you that Beersheba is on the way to Stockholm. So already then we took into consideration that possibility. And now, Mr. President, we both know that the real prize is peace itself.
In Beirut, Christians and Muslims fought all year.
This is George Kremsky in East Beirut on the edge of the fighting area where Syrian Christian positions have just broken the ceasefire and have resumed the three-day battle. The gunfire is coming just about 100 meters from where I'm talking now, on the other side of a line of residential buildings.
Kremsky ended up close to the war again while interviewing a Lebanese Christian identified only as Felipe. They were talking about the Syrians who had come to Beirut to keep the peace.
No doubt the Syrian army is stronger because they have got a bigger number of soldiers we have. They have a much better equipment, more ammunition, and much more sophisticated weapon to use than we do. But we believe that in this strength, let's say, or in the power.
Landed right in the terrace where we were talking. Is Claude all right?
All right.
Somebody must have spotted us, what?
That was a tank shooting on us because they've seen some people moving in the building. And as they're holding a few high buildings with binocular, they can cover all the area. And wherever they see someone moving, whether he's a civilian, a militian, a woman, or whatever it is, they shoot on it. And this is what just happened to us.
What hope do you have for the future? I mean, here you are. You obviously haven't shaved for maybe 5 days. You haven't got any drinking water. How long can you hold out like this?
Well, as long as we need to liberate our country.
Do you believe that a ceasefire is a good thing now?
No way. And this wouldn't resolve the problem. It should be either them or us.
In other words, a fight to the finish.
Right. No other way to resolve our problems.
Nicaragua burst into the headlines on January 10th when Pedro Chamorro, a newspaper editor who had been a staunch foe of the government of the ruling Somoza family, was gunned down. The government's opponents seethed and simmered for a while. Then a general strike was called, and protesters banging pots and pans urged a boycott of municipal elections. But the strike fizzled because the workers and their sympathetic employers could not afford to continue. Somoza told the Associated Press that Cuban infiltrators were behind the unrest.
We have already found people who have been trained in Cuba among the dead people who have opposed the authority. And we know that Havana Radio has been pumping Nicaragua to go on a rebellion.
Attacks on National Guard outposts were being made by a group of guerrillas calling themselves the Sandinista National Liberation Front. Their attacks increased, and on August 22nd, Sandinistas invaded the National Palace. The Sandinistas got $500,000 and won the release of 59 political prisoners. Soon after that crisis passed, the National Guard tried to clean out the Sandinista strongholds. Tom Fenton watched.
A National Guard airplane has just buzzed the city. Red Cross workers tell me that it was the type of aircraft used to launch rockets against some section of the city 3 days ago. The shooting appears to have stopped now, and the plane did not fire any rockets.
The AP's Lou Wheaton and other reporters and photographers got too close to the fighting at Masaya on September 11th.
Where the hell did he fire it?
I don't know. It was over there.
Somebody ought to get that 50 caliber. Give me that 50 caliber. I'll blow him out of the air.
Okay.
He's coming back. Guys. Making another run.
That's at us. I saw the smoke from that gun. I heard those bullets cutting the leaves over my head. He's turned away, guys.
No, he isn't.
Yes, he is.
He's making a low-level run.
Not toward us. He's going around that hill.
Oh, Red, get down.
Let's get out in the road.
The unrest continued despite imposition of martial law. Congressman Leo Ryan, reacting to constituent mail, took a fact-finding trip in November. Residents of his suburban San Francisco congressional district complained of family members being held against their will in Guyana at a farm colony run by a religious sect called the People's Temple, run by the Reverend Jim Jones. Ryan's visit ended in tragedy, described by a reporter along on the trip, Ron Javers of the San Francisco Chronicle, and sound man Steve Sung of NBC.
Don Harris, my correspondent, told us, me, Bob Brown and me, to spread out, get ready. There's trouble coming. So we're taking pictures, okay? All of a sudden, they pulled the tractor trailer all the way around. They all ducked down and pulled a gun out, high power rifle, basically, and start shooting.
It was like being in a war and you didn't have any guns.
Yeah.
They just approached us very quickly, came walking up with the guns, and started shooting people.
So everybody dived. Bob Brown hit the deck instantly, right? So I hit right next to him because it's minicams, a cable connecting to each other. They walking towards us. One shot hit Bob Brown, he screamed, ouch! And next thing I know, the guy came close and blew his brain off.
We were all lying on the ground, and I saw one young man with a very large rifle. It looked like the pictures from the Vietnamese War of someone administering the coup de grace.
I say, oh, next one be me who get killed, right? Next thing I know, I have a tremendous explosion right next to my head, but I won't dare to move one single muscle, so they thought I probably dead.
When I saw these men getting it in the head, my option was either to stay down and hit the deck as I did first, or to run, and I ran into the bush, and I jumped into a swamp, and I got as deep in that swamp as I could get, and then I stayed there, and then I paralleled the airport and came back to the plane when I saw it was all over.
Congressman Ryan, NBC newsman Don Harris, NBC cameraman Robert Brown, Greg Robinson, a photographer for the San Francisco Examiner, and Patricia Parks, described as a member of the sect, were killed. The day after the shootings, the government of Guyana discovered that people at the camp at Jonestown had committed suicide or had been murdered.
The people, when they committed suicide, stood in nice, neat little circles, children in front of them, and as they died, they filled an end to the interior of the circle, and there were mounds of people. And as we pulled off the surface cover, we found more and more people under the mounds. Apparently, it appeared as though there were children in front of the parents as they went over, then, of course, the parents went on top of them. All the bodies are up.
How many, sir?
There were 910 evacuated from this location.
Attorney Mark Lane, who was on Congressman Ryan's trip and who was in Jonestown when the death ritual began, told that bizarre tale.
Two men with weapons came down, and I don't know what their orders were, but they told me that we are all going to die now. And they were smiling. When these two men told us we're all going to die, I tried to persuade them not to, and they were clear that everyone was going to die. I said, well, at least Mr. Gary and I will be here to write the story of what happened in Jonestown. And he looked back and he stopped. He thought about that. And he said, okay. And he hugged me and he hugged Gary. And as they left, I said, how do I get out of here, Poncho? And he said, you can take a plane when it's all over. I said, I don't have a plane. I don't know when it'll be all over. How do I walk out? And he said, over the hill into the bush. And so he spent 24 hours in the bush.
The odor of rotting human flesh was in evidence as plane load after plane load of bodies from the mass suicide murder incident in Jonestown, Guyana, were unloaded here at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. The remains of more than 900 men, women, and children were flown here aboard Air Force C-141 jet transports. At the base mortuary, one of the largest on the East Coast, FBI fingerprint experts tried to positively identify all of the bodies, but the task was very difficult because so many of the corpses were in such an advanced state of decomposition from lying in the tropical heat of a South American jungle for up to a week. Mark Knoller at Dover Air Force Base, Delaware.
The news from Italy all year had a sameness to it. Fire set in political party offices. Fiat executive in Turin slain. Rome building executive kidnapped. Telephone exec wounded in Milan. Rome firebombs injure 7. Rome judge shot. Then the March 16th bulletin report from the AP's Victor Simpson, the man who had been premier of Italy 5 times, Aldo Moro, was kidnapped.
5 men leaped out from a hedge near a bar, opened fire with submachine guns, and killed 3 of Moro's bodyguards. 2 other men, meanwhile, jumped out of a car and with pistols shot Moro's 2 other bodyguards, then grabbed the former premier, put him into a car, and drove away.
The search for the kidnappers went on for weeks, with communiques coming from the Red Brigades, the terrorists who kidnapped him. Some messages included photos to assure that Moro was alive. Appeals came from the Pope and from United Nations Secretary General Waldheim.
Once more, I urge most strongly that you spare his life. I appeal to you to release him immediately. Such an act will be received with relief around the world, and all who dedicate their lives to seeking a world of greater justice and social well-being would applaud this move.
But the pleas were ignored, and on May 9th, the body was found. Michael Duffy went to the scene.
It's a small street, Via Michelangelo Caetani, right in the center of the city. Thousands of people have filled this street to pay their silent respects to Aldo Moro. Flowers have been placed on the spot where the car with his body was found. Not 2 blocks from here is the headquarters of the Christian Democrat Party, where Moro did much of his work during his life.
Pope Paul VI mourned the murder through an interpreter at a special audience for children.
His premeditated, calculated killing, done in secret and without pity, has made the whole city realize its horror. All of Italy is shaken by disdain, and the whole world is filled with pity. We knew him right from the time of his youth, when he was a student at university. This crime, the Holy Father went on, has shocked the whole world of honest people, all society. It is like a patch of blood that dishonors our country.
Some felt that the murder of his old friend Aldo Moro hit hard at the failing health of Pope Paul VI. In audiences, he spoke frequently of what he felt was his impending death. First word came from Vatican Radio.
We have to interrupt again our usual programs to repeat the sad news of the sudden death for our dear Holy Father, Pope Paul VI. His conditions became very critical in the course of the afternoon. He received the Holy Anointing and the Eucharistic Communion. His death occurred at 9:40 local time, p.m., at the summer residence of Castel Gandolfo.
Here in St. Peter's Square, in the heart of Vatican City, hundreds of people are gathered to pay homage to the late Pope Paul VI. The bright sunshine which bathed everything when the simple funeral cortege set out from Castel Gandolfo has dropped behind the dome of St. Peter's Basilica, and a steady breeze blows through the square. The late Pope's coffin is carried up the broad steps and into the basilica, where it can be visited by mourners until the funeral is held on Saturday. In the coolness, the mostly Italian crowd follows the mass attentively. Singing from the Sistine Chapel, the choir is heard in the square outside, where the mass is being celebrated. The red and white of the cardinals, the black and white of the other religious, contrasts vividly with what seems to be the almost solid black of the visiting dignitaries. Paul VI is being laid to rest with the same simplicity and dignity with which he sat for 15 years on the throne of St. Peter. Marcia Taylor, here in St. Peter's Square.
Then, 14 days later, the cardinals of the church on the first day of balloting sent the senior cardinal to announce their choice.
I bring you news of great joy. We have a pope.
Albino. Sante Romane Ecclesie Cardinale Luciani. Ioannis Paoli Brevi.
In less than an hour, Cardinal Luciani donned the papal robes and appeared before the crowd in St. Peter's Square to deliver his blessing. The crowd would remember him as the smiling pope. But the smiling face had to be engraved quickly in the mind. In just over a month, Vatican Radio repeated the sad word.
After 33 days, His Holiness John Paul I died. This morning, the 29th of September, 1978, about 5:30, the Pope's private secretary, Father John McGee, entered the bedroom of His Holiness John Paul I when he did not find him in his chapel, as was customary. Father McGee found him dead in bed with the light still switched on, just like a person who was reading. His doctor, who was summoned immediately, confirmed his decease, presumably towards 11 o'clock on the evening of the 20th of September, and gave the cause of his sudden death as an acute heart attack.
The scene is one of incredible color. The cardinals in their distinctive red, the 200 priests who will distribute the Eucharist in white, the delegations from various countries in black, among them President Carter's mother. Then in the main part of the square, the public, many with umbrellas poised, waiting for the rain. They're surrounded by the ochre-colored stonework of St. Peter's and the cobbled square itself. And in the background, the bells tolling from St. Peter's. The mass opens with Cardinal Confalieri offering the words, "Eternal rest grant unto them, O Lord," which the people congregated here at St. Peter's repeat. The body of Pope Jean Paul rests in a simple cypress coffin in front of the altar. In front of that, on the steps leading down to the basilica, are gathered the thousands and thousands of people who have come to witness this resurrection mass here at St. Peter's. The Sistine Choir leads the mass in the singing, and the people in the square respond. Vic Aiken, St. Peter's. Rome.
The smiling Pope laid to rest, the search began anew for a successor. Again in Rome, listeners were tuned to Vatican Radio for broadcasts in several languages.
The smoke is white, we now have a new Pope.
Habemus Papam! Eminentissimum ac reverendissimum Dominum, Dominum Carolum, Sancte Romane Ecclesie, Cardinalem Voitiva.
Madonna Santissima.
Pope John Paul II brought cheers to the crowds in St. Peter's Square by speaking in almost perfect Italian when he addressed them. He urged them to correct him if he made a mistake in their language. And then he paused and changed that, calling Italian our language. The crowd literally went wild.
Potrei bene spiegarmi nella vostra, la nostra lingua italiana, se mi sbaglio.
Senator Humphrey passed away quietly in his sleep at 9:25 p.m. The senator was comfortable throughout, and he suffered no pain.
Although he and I had many differences, and we probably would have if he had been president, I think if he had been elected, he would have held high the standard of being a president of the United States.
The United States Army Band is playing Martin Luther's hymn, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, as the flag-draped casket of Senator Hubert Humphrey is being carried up the steps of the United States Capitol into the rotunda. Here on the Capitol grounds, a military honor guard and policemen are standing at stiff attention in the freezing cold air, holding a salute as the Humphrey family follows that casket up the steps of the Capitol. This is Walter Rogers on Capitol Hill.
Where others wearied, he took strength. Where others turned aside, he embraced. Where others snarled, he smiled. Where others spoke in bitterness, he spoke in love.
Even as we mourn his death, we celebrate because such a man as Hubert Humphrey was among us.
Hubert will be remembered by all of us who served with him as one of the greatest legislators in our history. He will be remembered as one of the most loved men of his time. And even though he failed to realize his greatest goal, he achieved something much more rare and valuable than the nation's highest office. He became his country's conscience.